This is Audible Kids.
Imagination Studio presents The Cat in the Hat and Other Dr. Seuss Favorites by Dr. Seuss. Read for you by Kelsey Grammer, Dustin Hoffman, Walter Matthau, John Cleese, Ted Danson, John Lithgow, Mercedes McCambridge, and Billy Crystal. The Cat in the Hat.
The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So he sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day. I sat there with Sally. We sat there, we two. And I said, how I wish we had something to do. Too wet to go out, and too cold to play ball. So we sat in the house. We did nothing at all. So all we could do was to sit. 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 And we did not like it, not one little bit. And then, something went bump. How that bump made us jump. We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked, and we saw him. The Cat in the Hat. And he said to us, why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet and the sun is not sunny, but we can have lots of good fun that is funny. I know some good games we could play, said the cat. I know some new tricks, said the Cat in the Hat. A lot of good tricks, I will show them to you. Your mother will not mind at all if I do. Then Sally and I did not know what to say. Our mother was out of the house for the day. But our fish said, no, no, make that cat go away. Tell that Cat in the Hat you do not want to play. He should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out. Now, now, have no fear, have no fear, said the cat. My tricks are not bad, said the Cat in the Hat. Why, we can have lots of good fun, if you wish, with a game that I call Up, Up, Up with a Fish. Put me down, said the fish. This is no fun at all. Put me down, said the fish. I do not wish to fall. Have no fear, said the cat. I will not let you fall. I will hold you up high as I stand on a ball, with a book on one hand and a cup on my hat. But that is not all I can do, said the cat. Look at me. Look at me now, said the cat. With a cup and a cake on the top of my hat, I can hold up two books, I can hold up the fish, and a little toy ship, and some milk on a dish. And look, I can hop up and down on the ball, but that is not all. Oh, no, that is not all. Look at me! Look at me! Look at me now! It is fun to have fun, but you have to know how. I can hold up the cup and the milk and the cake. I can hold up these books and the fish on a rake. I can hold the toy ship and a little toy man. And look, with my tail, I can hold a red fan. I can fan with the fan as I hop on the ball. But that is not all. Oh, no, that is not all. That is what the cat said. Then he fell on his head. He came down with a bump from up there on the ball, and Sally and I, we saw all the things fall. And our fish came down too. He fell into a pot. He said, do I like this? Oh, no, I do not. This is not a good game, said our fish as he lit. No, I do not like it, not one little bit. Now look what you did, said the fish to the cat. Now look at this house, look at this, look at that. You sank our toy ship, sank it deep in the cake. You shook up our house and you bent our new rake. You should not be here when our mother is not. You get out of this house, said the fish in the pot. But I like to be here. Oh, I like it a lot, said the Cat in the Hat to the fish in the pot. I will not go away. I do not wish to go. And so, said the Cat in the Hat. So? 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 Show you another good game that I know. And then he ran out, and then fast as a fox, the Cat in the Hat came back in with a box. A big red wood box. It was shut with a hook. Now look at this trick, said the cat. Take a look. Then he got up on top with the tip of his hat. I call this game Fun in a Box, said the cat. In this box are two things I will show to you now. You will like these two things, said the cat with a bow. I will pick up the hook. You will see something new. Two things, and I call them Thing One and Thing Two. These things will not bite you. They want to have fun. Then out of the box came Thing Two and Thing One, and they ran to us fast. They said, how do you do? Would you like to shake hands with Thing One and Thing Two? And Sally and I did not know what to do, so we had to shake hands with Thing One and Thing Two. We shook their two hands, but our fish said, "No, no, those things should not be in this house. Make them go. They should not be here when your mother is not. Put them out," said the fish in the pot. "Have no fear, little fish," said the Cat in the Hat. "These things are good things." And he gave them a pat. "They are tame, oh, so tame. They have come here to play. They will give you some fun on this wet, wet, wet day." "Now here is a game that they like," said the Cat. "They like to fly kites," said the Cat in the Hat. "No, not in the house," said the fish in the pot. "They should not fly kites in a house. They should not. Oh, the things they will bump. Oh, the things they will hit. Oh, I do not like it, not one little bit." Then Sally and I saw them run down the hall. We saw those two things bump their kites on the wall, bump, thump, thump, bump, down the wall in the hall. Thing Two and Thing One, they ran up, they ran down. On the string of one kite, we saw Mother's new gown, her gown with the dots that are pink, white, and red. Then we saw one kite bump on the head of her bed. Then those things ran about with big bumps, jumps, and kicks, and with hops and big thumps and all kinds of bad tricks. And I said, "I do not like the way that they play. If Mother could see this, oh, what would she say?" Then our fish said, "Look, look," and our fish shook with fear. "Your mother is on her way home, do you hear? Oh, what will she do to us? What will she say? Oh, she will not like it to find us this way." "So do something fast," said the fish. "Do you hear? I saw her, your mother. Your mother is near. So as fast as you can think of something to do, you will have to get rid of Thing One and Thing Two." So as fast as I could, I went after my net, and I said, "With my net, I can get them. I bet with my net, I can get those things yet." Then I let down my net. It came down with a plop, and I had them at last. Those two things had to stop. Then I said to the Cat, "Now you do as I say. You pack up those things, and you take them away." "Oh, dear," said the Cat. "You did not like our game. Oh, dear. What a shame. What a shame. What a shame." Then he shut up the things in the box with the hook, and the Cat went away with a sad kind of look. "That is good," said the fish. "He has gone away, yes, but your mother will come. She will find this big mess, and this mess is so big and so deep and so tall, we cannot pick it up. There is no way at all." And then, who was back in the house? Why, the Cat. "Have no fear of this mess," said the Cat in the Hat. "I always pick up all my playthings, and so I will show you another good trick that I know." Then we saw him pick up all the things that were down. He picked up the cake and the rake and the gown and the milk and the strings and the books and the dish and the fan and the cup and the ship and the fish, and he put them away. Then he said, "That is that." And then he was gone with a tip of his hat. Then our mother came in, and she said to us two, "Did you have any fun? Tell me, what did you do?" And Sally and I did not know what to say. Should we tell her the things that went on there that day? Should we tell her about it? Now, what should we do? Well, what would you do if your mother asked you?
Horton Hears a Who.
On the 15th of May, in the jungle of Newell, in the heat of the day, in the cool of the pool, he was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise. So Horton stopped splashing. He looked toward the sound. "That's funny," thought Horton. "There's no one around." Then he heard it again, just a very faint yelp, as if some tiny person were calling for help. "I'll help you," said Horton. "But who are you? Where?" He looked and he looked. He could see nothing there but a small speck of dust blowing past through the air. "I say," murmured Horton, "I've never heard tell of a small speck of dust that is able to yell. So you know what I think? Why, I think that there must be someone on top of that small speck of dust. Some sort of a creature of very small size, too small to be seen by an elephant's eyes.
some poor little person who's shaking with fear that he'll blow in the pool. He has no way to steer. I'll just have to save him because, after all, a person's a person no matter how small.
So gently and using the greatest of care, the elephant stretched his great trunk through the air, and he lifted the dust speck and carried it over and placed it down safe on a very soft clover.
"Humph!" humped a voice. 'Twas a sour kangaroo, and the young kangaroo in her pouch said, "Humph!" too. "Why, that speck is as small as the head of a pin. A person on that? Why, there never has been."
"Believe me," said Horton, "I tell you sincerely, my ears are quite keen, and I heard him quite clearly. I know there's a person down there. And what's more, quite likely there's two, even three, even four. Quite likely a family, for all that we know. A family with children just starting to grow." "So please," Horton said, "as a favor to me, try not to disturb them. Just please let them be."
"I think you're a fool," laughed the sour kangaroo. And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, "Me too. You're the biggest blame fool in the jungle of Newell."
And the kangaroos plunged in the cool of the pool. "What terrible splashing," the elephant frowned. "I can't let my very small persons get drowned. I've got to protect them. I'm bigger than they." So he plucked up the clover and hustled away. Through the high jungle treetops, the news quickly spread.
"He talks to a dust speck. He's out of his head. Just look at him walk with that speck on that flower."
And Horton walked worrying almost an hour. "Should I put this speck down?" Horton thought with alarm. "If I do, these small persons may come to great harm. I can't put it down, and I won't. After all, a person's a person, no matter how small." Then Horton stopped walking. The speck voice was talking. The voice was so faint he could just barely hear it. "Speak up, please," said Horton. He put his ear near it.
"My friend,"
came the voice.
"You're a very fine friend. You've helped those folks on this dust speck no end. You've saved all our houses, our ceilings and floors. You've saved all our churches and grocery stores."
"You mean," Horton gasped, "you have buildings there too?"
"Oh, yes,"
piped the voice.
"We most certainly do. I know,"
called the voice.
"I'm too small to be seen, but I'm mayor of a town that is friendly and clean. Our buildings to you would seem terribly small, but to us who aren't big, they are wonderfully tall. My town is called Whoville, for I am a who. And we Whos are all thankful and grateful to you."
And Horton called back to the mayor of the town. "You're safe now. Don't worry. I won't let you down." But just as he spoke to the mayor of the speck, three big jungle monkeys climbed up Horton's neck. The Wickersham brothers came shouting,
"What? What? This elephant's talking to who's who are not. There aren't any who's, and they don't have a mayor, and we're gonna stop all this nonsense, so there."
They snatched Horton's clover. They carried it off to a black-bottom eagle named Vlad Vladikoff, a mighty strong eagle of very swift wing. And they said, "Will you kindly get rid of this thing?" And before the poor elephant even could speak, that eagle flew off with the flower in his beak.
All that late afternoon and far into the night, that black-bottomed bird flapped his wings in fast flight, while Horton chased after with groans over stones that tattered his toenails and battered his bones, and begged, "Please don't harm all my little folks who have as much right to live as us bigger folks do." But far, far beyond him, that eagle kept flapping, and over his shoulder called back, "Quit your yapping! I'll fly the night through. I'm a bird. I don't mind it. And I'll hide this tomorrow where you'll never find it."
And at 6:56 the next morning, he did it. It sure was a terrible place that he hid it. He let that small clover drop somewhere inside of a great patch of clovers 100 miles wide.
"Find that," sneered the bird, "but I think you will fail." And he left with a flip of his black-bottomed tail.
"I'll find it," cried Horton. "I'll find it or bust. I shall find my friends on my small speck of dust."
And clover by clover by clover, with care, he picked up and searched them and called,
"Are you there?"
But clover by clover by clover, he found that the one that he sought for was just not around. And by noon, poor old Horton, more dead than alive, had picked, searched, and piled up 9,005. Then on through the afternoon, hour after hour, till he found them at last on the 3,000,000th flower.
"My friends," cried the elephant, "tell me, do tell, are you safe? Are you sound? Are you whole? Are you well?"
From down on the speck came the voice of the mare.
"We've really had trouble, much more than our share. When that black-bottomed birdie let go and we dropped, we landed so hard that our clocks have all stopped. Our teapots are broken, our rocking chairs smashed, and our bicycle tires all blew up when we crashed. Sir Horton, please,"
pleaded that voice of the mare's,
"will you stick by us hooves while we're making repairs?"
"Of course," Horton answered. "Of course I will stick. I'll stick by you small folks through thin and through thick."
"Humph," humped a voice. "Almost 2 days you've run wild and insisted on chatting with persons who've never existed. Such carryings on in our peaceable jungle. We've had quite enough of your bellowing bungle. And I'm here to state," snapped the big kangaroo, "that your silly nonsensical game is all through."
And the young kangaroo in her pouch said,
"Me too!" With the help of the Wickersham brothers and dozens of Wickersham uncles and Wickersham cousins and Wickersham in-laws whose help I've engaged, you're going to be roped and you're going to be caged. And as for your dust speck, ha! That we shall boil in a hot steaming kettle of beazle nut oil."
"Boil it?" gasped Horton. "Oh, that you can't do. It's all full of persons. They'll prove it to you." "Mr. Mayor! Mr. Mayor!" Horton called. "Mr. Mayor, you've got to prove now that you really are there. So call a big meeting. Get everyone out. Make every who holler. Make every who shout. Make every who scream. If you don't, every who is going to end up in a beazle nut stew."
And down on the dust speck, the scared little mayor quick called a big meeting in Whoville Town Square. And his people cried loudly. They cried out in fear,
"We are here! We are here! We are here! We are here!"
The elephant smiled. "That was clear as a bell. You kangaroo surely heard that very well.
All I heard,
snapped the big kangaroo,
was the breeze and the faint sound of wind through the far distant trees. I heard those small voices, and you didn't either.
And the young kangaroo in her pouch said,
me neither.
Grab him, they shouted, and cage the big dope. Lasso his stomach with 10 miles of rope. Tie the knots tight so he'll never shake loose. Then dunk that dumb speck in the measle nut juice.
Horton fought back with great vigor and vim, but the Wickersham gang was too many for him. They beat him, they mauled him, they started to haul him into his cage, but he managed to call to the mayor, "Don't give up, I believe in you all. A person to person, no matter how small. And you very small persons will not have to die if you make yourselves heard. So come on now and try." The mayor grabbed a tom-tom. He started to smack it. And all over Whoville, they whooped up a racket. They rattled tin kettles. They beat on brass pans, on garbage pail tops, and old cranberry cans. They blew on bazookas and blasted great toots, on clarinets, oompahs, and boompahs, and flutes. Great gusts of loud racket rang high through the air. They rattled and shook the whole sky, and the mayor called up through the howling mad hullabaloo,
"Hey, Horton! How's this? Hear a sound coming through?"
And Horton called back, "I can hear you just fine, but the kangaroo's ears aren't as strong quite as mine. They don't hear a thing. Are you sure all your boys are doing their best? Are they all making noise? Are you sure every who down in Whoville is working? Quick, look through your town. Is there anyone shirking?" Through the town rushed the mayor from the east to the west, but everyone seemed to be doing his best. Everyone seemed to be yapping or yipping. Everyone seemed to be beeping or bipping, but it wasn't enough, all this ruckus and roar. He had to find someone to help him make more. He raced through each building, he searched floor to floor. And just as he felt he was getting nowhere, and almost about to give up in despair, he suddenly burst through a door, and that mayor discovered one shirker, quite hidden away in the Fairfax Apartments, apartment 12J. A very small shirker named Jojo was standing, just standing, and bouncing a yo-yo. Not making a sound, not a yip, not a chirp, and the mayor rushed inside and he grabbed the young twerp. And he climbed with the lad up the Eiffelberg Tower.
"This,"
cried the mayor,
"is your town's darkest hour. The time for all Whos who have blood that is red to come to the aid of their country,"
he said.
"We've got to make noises in greater amounts. So open your mouth, lad, for every voice counts."
Thus he spoke as he climbed. When they got to the top, the lad cleared his throat and he shouted out,
"Yap!"
And that yap, that one small extra yap, put it over. Finally, at last, from that speck on that clover, their voices were heard. They rang out clear and clean, and the elephant smiled. "Do you see what I mean? They've proved they are persons, no matter how small. And their whole world was saved by the smallest of all."
"How true, yes, how true," said the big kangaroo. "And from now on, you know what I'm planning to do. From now on, I'm going to protect them with you."
And the young kangaroo in her pouch said,
"Me too. from sun in the summer, from rain when it's fallish, I'm going to protect them, no matter how smallish.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot. But the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas. The whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. But whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve hating the Whos, staring down from his cave with a sour, grinchy frown at the warm, lighted windows below in their town, for he knew every Who down in Whoville beneath was busy now, hanging a mistletoe wreath.
"And they're hanging their stockings,"
he snarled with a sneer.
"Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here."
Then he growled, with his Grinch fingers nervously drumming,
"I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming."
For tomorrow, he knew, all the Who girls and boys would wake bright and early. They'd rush for their toys, and then... Oh, the noise. Oh, the noise, 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 noise. That's one thing he hated. The noise, 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 noise. Then the Whos, young and old, would sit down to a feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, 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 feast. They would feast on Who pudding and rare Who roast beast, which was something the Grinch couldn't stand in the least. And then they'd do something he liked least of all. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, would stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'd stand hand in hand, and the Whos would start singing. They'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing, 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 sing. And the more the Grinch thought of this Who Christmas sing, the more the Grinch thought,
"I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years... I've put up with it now. I must stop this Christmas from coming. But how?"
Then he got an idea. An awful idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea.
"I know just what to do."
The Grinch laughed in his throat, and he made a quick Santa Claus hat and a coat, and he chuckled and clucked.
"What a great Grinchy trick! With this coat and this hat, I look just like St. Nick. All I need is a reindeer."
The Grinch looked around, but since reindeer are scarce, there was none to be found. Did that stop the old Grinch? No. The Grinch simply said,
"If I can find a reindeer, I'll make one instead."
So he called his dog Max. Then he took some red thread, and he tied a big horn on the top of his head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackle sleigh, and he hitched up old Max. Then the Grinch said,
"Giddap!"
And the sleigh started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a snooze in their town. All their windows were dark. Quiet snow filled the air. All the Whos were all dreaming sweet dreams without care when he came to the first little house on the square.
"This is stop number one,"
the old Grinchy Claus hissed. And he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist. Then he slid down the chimney, a rather tight pinch. But if Santa could do it, then so could the Grinch. He got stuck only once for a moment or two. Then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue where the little Who stockings all hung in a row.
"These stockings," he grinned, "are the first things to go."
Then he slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present, pop guns and bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorn and plums, and he stuffed them in bags. Then the Grinch, very nimbly, stuffed all the bags one by one up the chimney. Then he slunk to the icebox, he took the Who's feast. He took the Who pudding, he took the roast beast. He cleaned out that icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took their last can of Who hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee.
"And now,"
grinned the Grinch,
"I will stuff up the tree."
And the Grinch grabbed the tree and he started to shove when he heard a small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small Who. Little Cindy Lou who was not more than two. The Grinch had been caught by this tiny Who daughter who'd got out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch and said,
"Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why?"
But you know that old Grinch was so smart and so slick, he thought up a lie, and he thought it up quick.
"Why, my sweet little tot,"
the fake Santa Claus lied,
"there's a light on this tree that won't light on one side. So I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there. Then I'll bring it back here."
And his fib fooled the child. And he patted her head, and he got her a drink, and he sent her to bed. And when Cindy Lou Who went to bed with her cup, he went to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. Then the last thing he took was the log for their fire. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb that was even too small for a mouse. Then he did the same thing to the other Who's houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other Who's mouses. It was quarter past dawn, all the Who's still abed, all the Who's still a snooze, when he packed up his sled, packed it up with their presents, the ribbons, the wrappings, the tags and the tinsel, the trimmings, the trappings. 3,000 feet up, up the side of Mount Crumpet, he rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it.
"Pooh-pooh to the Who's,"
he was grinchishly humming.
"They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two, and the Who's down in Whoville will all cry, 'Boo-hoo!' That's a noise,"
grinned the Grinch,
"that I simply must hear."
So he paused, and the Grinch put his hand to his ear, and he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. The sound wasn't sad. Why, this sound sounded merry. It couldn't be so, but it was merry. Very. He stared down at Whoville. The Grinch popped his eyes. Then he shook. What he saw was a shocking surprise. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing. Without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling.
How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags.
And he puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before.
Maybe Christmas,
he thought,
doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day. And the minute his heart didn't feel quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light, and he brought back the toys and the food for the feast. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast.
Did I ever tell you how lucky you are?
When I was quite young and quite small for my size, I met an old man in the desert of Dries, and he sang me a song I will never forget. At least, well, I haven't forgotten it yet. He sat in a terribly prickly place, but he sang with a sunny, sweet smile on his face. When you think things are bad, when you feel sour and blue, when you start to get mad, you should do what I do. Just tell yourself, ducky, you're really quite lucky. Some people are much more, oh, ever so much more, oh, muchly much, much more unlucky than you. Be glad you don't work on the Bungle-Bung Bridge that they're building across Booba Bay at Bum Ridge. It's a troublesome world. All the people who are in it are troubled with troubles almost every minute. You ought to be thankful, a whole heaping lot, for the places and people you're lucky you're not. Just suppose, for example, you lived in Gazette and got caught in that traffic on Zate Highway 8. Or suppose, just for instance, you lived in Gazette with your bedroom up here and your bathroom up there. Suppose you were poor Herbie Hart, who has taken his thrombimbulator apart. He never will get it together, I'm sure. He never will know if the gick or the gore fits into the scrux or the snux or the snore. Yes, ducky, you're lucky you're not Herbie Hart, who has taken his thrombimbulator apart. Think they work you too hard? Think of poor Arlie Sard. He has to mow grass in his uncle's backyard. And it's quick-growing grass, and it grows as he mows it. The faster he mows it, the faster he grows it. and all that his stingy old uncle will pay for his shoving that mower around in that hay is the pifulous pay of 2 dukelas a day, and Arlie can't live on such pifulous pay. So, he has to paint flagpoles on Sundays in Grues. How lucky you are you don't live in his shoes. And poor Mr. Bix. Every morning at 6, poor Mr. Bix has his boffin to fix. It doesn't seem fair, it just doesn't seem right. But his boffin just seems to go schlump every night. It schlumps in a heap, sadly needing repair. Bix figures it's due to the local night air. It takes him all day to unschlump it, and then the night air comes back and it schlumps once again. So don't you feel blue. Don't get down in the dumps. You're lucky you don't have a boffin that schlumps. And while we are at it, consider the schlots, the crumple-horn, web-footed, green-bearded schlots, whose tail is entailed with unsolvable knots. If he isn't muchly more worse off than you, I'll eat my umbrella. That's just what I'll do. And you're lucky indeed you don't ride on a camel. To ride on a camel, you sit on a whammel. A whammel, you know, is a sort of a saddle held on by a button that's known as a faddle. And boy, if your old whammel faddle gets loose, I'm telling you, ducky, you're gone like a goose. And poor Mr. Potter, T-crosser, I-dotter. He has to cross T's and he has to dot I's in an I and T factory out in Van Nuys. Oh, the jobs people work at. Out west, near Hotch Hotch, there's a Hotch Hotcher bee watcher. His job is to watch, is to keep both his eyes on the lazy town bee. A bee that is watched will work harder, you see. Well, he watched and he watched, but in spite of his watch, that bee didn't work any harder, not much. So then somebody said, our old bee-watching man just isn't bee-watching as hard as he can. He ought to be watched by another hotch-hotcher. The thing that we need is a bee-watcher-watcher. Well, the bee-watcher-watcher watched the bee-watcher. He didn't watch well. So another hotch-hotcher had to come in as a watch-watcher-watcher. And today, all the hotchers who live in Hotch Hotch are watching on watch-watcher-watchering-watch. Watch-watching the watcher who's watching that bee. You're not a hotch-watcher, you're lucky, you see? And how fortunate you're not Professor DeBries, who has spent the past 32 years, if you please, trying to teach Irish ducks how to read Givenese. And think of the poor puffing Pugelhorn players who have to parade down the Pugelhorn stairs every morning to wake up the Prince of Pooboken. It's awful how often their Pugels get broken. And, oh, just suppose you were poor Harry Haddo. Try as he will, he can't make any shadow. He thinks that perhaps something's wrong with his giz, and I think that, by golly, there probably is. And the Brothers Bazoo, the poor Brothers Bazoo. Suppose your hair grew like theirs happened to do. You think you're unlucky. I'm telling you, Ducky, some people are muchly, oh, ever so muchly, muchly more unlucky than you. And suppose that you lived in that forest in France, where the average young person just hasn't a chance to escape from the perilous pants-eating plants. But your pants are safe, you're a fortunate guy, and you ought to be shouting, how lucky am I? And speaking of plants, you should be greatly gladdish you're not Farmer Falkenberg's 17th radish. And you're so lucky
You're not Gucky Gown, who lives by himself 90 miles out of town in the ruins of Ronk. Ronk is rather run down. And you're so lucky you're not a left sock left behind, by mistake, in the caverns of Krok. Thank goodness for all of the things you are not. Thank goodness you're not something someone forgot and left all alone in some punkerish place like a rusty tin coat hanger hanging in space. That's why I say, Ducky, don't grumble, don't stew. Some critters are much, much, oh, ever so much, much, so muchly, much, much more unlucky than you.
The Lorax.
At the far end of town, where the grickle grass grows, and the wind smells slow and sour when it blows, and no birds ever sing, excepting old crows, is the street of the lifted Lorax. And deep in the grickle grass, some people say, if you look deep enough, you can still see, today, where the Lorax once stood just as long as it could, before somebody lifted the Lorax away. What was the Lorax? And why was it there? And why was it lifted and taken somewhere from the far end of town where the grickle grass grows? The old Onceler still lives here. Ask him. He knows. You won't see the Onceler. Don't knock at his door. He stays in his lurkum on top of his store. He lurks in his lurkum, cold under the roof, where he makes his own clothes out of miff-muffered moof. And on special dank midnights in August, he peeks out of the shutters, and sometimes he speaks and tells how the Lorax was lifted away. He'll tell you, perhaps, if you're willing to pay. On the end of a rope, he lets down a tin pail, and you have to toss in 15 cents and a nail, and the shell of a great, great, great grandfather snail. Then he pulls up the pail, makes a most careful count, to see if you've paid him the proper amount. Then he hides what you paid him away in his snub, his secret strange hole in his grovulous glove. Then he grunts. I will call you by whisper-ma-phone. For the secrets I tell are for your ears alone.
Slup!
Down slups the whisper-ma-phone to your ear, and the old Onceler's whispers are not very clear, since they have to come down through a snurgly hose, and he sounds as if he had smallish bees up his nose.
Now I'll tell you,
he says with his teeth sounding gray,
how the Lorax got lifted and taken away. It all started way back, such a long, long time back. Way back in the days when the grass was still green, the pond was still wet, and the clouds were still clean, and the song of the Swami Swans rang out in space. One morning, I came to this glorious place, and I first saw the trees, the truffula trees, the bright colored tufts of the truffula trees, mile after mile in the fresh morning breeze. And under the trees, I saw brown barbaloots frisking about in their barbaloot suits as they played in the shade and ate truffula fruits. From the ripulous pond came the comfortable sound
of the humming fish humming while splashing around. But those truffula trees, all my life I've been searching for trees such as these. The touch of their tufts was much softer than silk, and they had this sweet smell of fresh butterfly milk. I felt a great leaping of joy in my heart. I knew just what I'd do. I unloaded my cart. In no time at all, I had built a small shop. Then I chopped down a truffula tree with one chop. And with great skillful skill and with great speedy speed, I took the soft tuft. And I knitted a thneed. The instant I'd finished, I heard a gazump. I looked. I saw something pop out of the stump of the tree I chopped down. It was sort of a man. Describe him? That's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy. And he spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy.
"Mister,"
he said with a sawdusty sneeze.
"I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees, for the trees have no tongues. And I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs..."
He was very upset as he shouted and puffed.
"What's that thing you've made out of my truffula tuft?"
"Look, Lorax," I said, "there's no cause for alarm. I chopped just one tree. I'm doing no harm. I'm being quite useful. This thing is a thneed. A thneed's a fine something that all people need. It's a shirt, it's a sock, it's a glove, it's a hat. But it has other uses, yes, far beyond that. You can use it for carpets, for pillows, for sheets, or curtains, or covers for bicycle seats." The Lorax said,
"Sir, you are crazy with greed. There is no one on earth who would buy that fool thneed."
But the very next minute, I proved he was wrong. For just at that minute, a chap came along. And he thought that the thneed I had knitted was great. He happily bought it for $3.98. I laughed at the Lorax. "You poor, stupid guy. You never can tell what some people will buy."
"I repeat,"
cried the Lorax,
"I speak for the trees."
"I'm busy," I told him. "Shut up, if you please." I rushed across the room and in no time at all built a radio phone. I put in a quick call. I called all my brothers and uncles and aunts and I said, "Listen here, here's a wonderful chance for the whole Wunstler family to get mighty rich. Get over here fast. Take the road to North Niche, turn left at Weehawken, sharp right at South Stitch." And in no time at all in the factory I built, the whole Wunstler family was working full tilt. We were all knitting thneeds, just as busy as bees, to the sound of the chopping of truffula trees. Then, oh, baby, oh, how my business did grow. Now chopping one tree at a time was too slow. So I quickly invented my super axe packer, which whacked off four truffula trees at one smacking. We were making thneeds four times as fast as before. And that Lorax? He didn't show up anymore. But the next week, he knocked on my new office door. He snapped,
"I'm the Lorax who speaks for the trees, which you seem to be chopping as fast as you please. But I'm also in charge of the brown barbaloots, who played in the shade in their barbaloot suits, and happily lived eating truffula fruits. Now, thanks to your hacking my trees to the ground, there's not enough truffula fruit to go round. My poor barbaloots are all getting the crummies because they have gas and no food in their tummies. They loved living here, but I can't let them stay. They'll have to find food, and I hope that they may. Good luck, boys!"
He cried, and he sent them away. I, the Wunstler, felt sad as I watched them all go.
But business is business, and business must grow, regardless of crummies and tummies, you know. I meant no harm. I most truly did not. But I had to grow bigger, so bigger I got. I biggered my factory, I biggered my roads, I biggered my wagons, I biggered the loads of the needs I shipped out. I was shipping them forth to the south, to the east, to the west, to the north. I went right on biggering, selling more needs. And I biggered my money, which everyone needs. Then again he came back. I was fixing some pipes when that old nuisance Lorax came back with more gripes.
I am the Lorax.
He coughed and he whiffed. He sneezed and he snuffled. He snarled. He sniffed.
Wunschler!
He cried with a cruffulous croak.
Wunschler, you're making such smogulous smoke. My poor swami swans, why, they can't sing a note. No one can sing who has smog in his throat. And so,
said the Lorax,
please pardon my cough. They cannot live here, so I'm sending them off. Where will they go? I don't hopefully know. They may have to fly for a month or a year to escape from the smog you've smogged up around here. What's more,
snapped the Lorax. His dander was up.
Let me say a few words about Gluppity Glup. Your machinery chugs on day and night without stop, making Gluppity Glup. Also, Sloppity Slop. And what do you do with this leftover goo? I'll show you, you dirty old Wunschler man, you. You're glumping the pond where the humming fish hummed. No more can they hum, for their gills are all gummed. So I'm sending them off. Oh, their future is dreary. They'll walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary.
And then I got mad. I got terribly mad. I yelled at the Lorax, now listen here, Dad. All you do is yep, yep, and say bad, 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 bad. Well, I have my rights, sir, and I'm telling you, I intend to go on doing just what I do. And for your information, you Lorax, I'm figuring on biggering and biggering and biggering and biggering, turning more truffula trees into thneeds, which everyone, everyone, everyone needs. And at that very moment, we heard a loud whack. From outside in the fields came a sickening smack of an axe on a tree. Then we heard the tree fall. The very last truffula tree of them all. No more trees, no more thneeds, no more work to be done. So, in no time, my uncles and aunts, everyone, all waved me goodbye. They jumped into my cars and drove away under the smoke-smothered stars. Now all that was left beneath the bad-smelling sky was my big, empty factory, the Lorax, and I. The Lorax said nothing, just gave me a glance, just gave me a very sad, sad backward glance as he lifted himself by the seat of his pants. And I'll never forget the grim look on his face when he heisted himself and took leave of this place through a hole in the smog without leaving a trace. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with the one word, unless. Whatever that meant, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago. But each day since that day, I've sat here and worried away. Through the years, while my buildings have fallen apart, I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, says the Onceler,